Moline 89.3, KPCC, Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. Today, we are going to be talking in just about a half an hour about youth sports and the decline in participation that researchers have been seeing in youth sports and what's behind that. So if you are somebody that has kids that are thinking about joining or maybe quitting a sport, if you yourself were a kid that dropped out of sports early, tell us why. We want to hear from you. You can give us a call at 866-893-5722. You can write on our AirTalk page. You can also go on Twitter or Facebook. We're available on all the social media channels. No TikTok page yet, though. Maybe there will be a TikTok AirTalk page coming up pretty soon. That's it, coming up in about a half an hour here. But on August 8th, in the meantime, there was a mysterious explosion at a nuclear facility in the north of Russia. The cause has not been confirmed, and we still don't have many answers about what happened. But experts speculate this was a failed launch of a new type of weapon Russia is working on. It's a nuclear-powered cruise missile that could evade U.S. missile defense systems. This is just the latest development in what appears to be a return of certain parts of the nuclear arms race of the Cold War. And we want to look at what's been happening between the U.S. and Russia with an eye to history and the history of nuclear negotiations between these two countries. Journalist Guillaume Serena is in studio with me now. He is the author of a new book, An Impossible Dream, Reagan, Gorbachev, and A World Without the Bomb. Guillaume, thank you so much for being on Air Talk today.
Thank you for having me. I'm honored.
So you're also the outreach coordinator for the International School of Los Angeles. You've published 5 books in French, including the first French language biography of Barack Obama. But this is your first English language book, so that's very exciting as well.
Absolutely.
So what do we know about what happened in Russia on August 8th? Was this a new kind of missile? And where does it fit in the nuclear arms race that's really been going on for half a century now?
Well, as you just said, we don't really know exactly what happened. From American sources, we know that it might have been a missile being tested and a new kind of missile, as you said, with a nuclear propulsion system. So if that's the truth, there was not a nuclear warhead on it, because obviously that would have been noticed way more. But with instead of fuel, this missile would have been propelled by a nuclear system. So that's what happened. We count, I think, 7 dead people. A town was evacuated, but it's still pretty unclear.
Yeah, and it's not a lot of information coming out of the Russian government. We know that President Putin presented these new types of weapons at an event in March of last year. And one of them was like an underwater weapon that could evade U.S. missile defense systems. This one would be the nuclear-powered cruise missile. If this is indeed what happened in northern Russia, since we don't know for sure, it would be something that would also fly below sort of the general arc of an intercontinental ballistic missile, and so therefore also evade missile systems. So this seems to really be directly aimed at circumventing U.S. defenses, mm-hmm. right? I mean, this is like a major step in the way that these two countries relate in a nuclear arms race.
Well, for sure, we are in a new arms race. That's for sure, since at least a couple of years. First of all, because most of these missiles and material were obsolete for a long time, since the 80s. So both countries, actually, Russia and the United States, started to modernize, started to miniaturize, started to invent new forms of weapons. So, of course, being not detected is a huge, huge strategic importance. And what we see is truly something worrying between these two countries. We're not even talking about China, that we know is probably hiding a lot of its weapons.
Guillaume Serena joins me right now. His new book is about a historic summit that occurred in 1986 between President Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev in Iceland, in Reykjavik. The book's called An Impossible Dream, Reagan, Gorbachev, and A World Without the Bomb. You know, I want to get to the events of your book because I think that it really illustrates something important in the history of nuclear negotiations, and it teaches us so much about what's going on today. I think, first of all, though, you know, to see these new weapons being developed, to see arsenals being invested in a way that I wasn't aware of before reading your book, I always assumed, being a child during the 80s, not remembering the Cold War, that we just had this web of agreements that protected us from any kind of looming Armageddon. You know, it's not war games anymore. You know, our big threat on the world stage is terrorism. But what I'm seeing now is major world powers once again amping up their arsenals and potentially creating tension points that could lead again to the threat of nuclear war. I mean, it just seems unbelievable to me.
Right. Well, at the time, in the Cold War, you had basically two huge superpowers holding about 95% of nuclear weapons, right? The United States and the Soviet Union. Today, indeed, we're dealing with a much more unstable situation on the world scale. And today we have 9 countries having nuclear weapons. And the total number of them is more than 13,000 warheads today. But at the time, it was even way more, the double. So you had these two superpowers. Of course, it was scary, but it was the time of deterrence, you know, of MAD being mutual assured destruction, right? So in a way, these two players were rational. They were holding their backs. And of course, there were discussions at low levels and higher levels, like in Reykjavik in 1986. Today, I think the world is way more unstable. You know, key players are less predictable. You have, obviously, the North Korea situation. You have the South China Sea situation. You have India and Pakistan, as we see right now, as we speak. It's very, very tense in Kashmir. So the world changed. And unfortunately, in 86 in Reykjavik, we had a window to maybe get rid of all nuclear weapons, and didn't happen for one detail.
Yeah, so I want to get to that, because that's the subject of your book. Stepping back in history, you know, this 1986 summit in Reykjavik, two leaders in a, you know, relatively modest house in Iceland. You know, what is the purpose of this summit? Why are Mikhail Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan meeting? And what are both sides hoping to get out of this summit?
Well, first we need to remind our listeners that Gorbachev arrived in 85 in power and was pretty unknown from the rest of the world. You know, all the Soviet leaders died one after another. They were very old people. And there hadn't been a meeting between a U.S. president and a Soviet leader since 1979. So when Gorbachev takes power, Ronald Reagan just starts his second term. And there's a pretty great impatience on both sides to meet. So they meet in Geneva for the first time. They talk, they break the ice, you know, they say nice words. They start to work on some important files, but it was mostly to break the ice and to get to know each other. And the Americans actually started to feel like, you can work with Gorbachev. He's different. You know, something's going on in
Moscow.
He's
new guard. He's a different generation.
And he's much younger. He's only 55 at the time. Absolutely. And in the spring of 1986, you had a couple of things happening really important in the Soviet Union. First of it was, of course, the explosion in Chernobyl in Soviet Ukraine, that huge nuclear disaster. There was also the Danilov case, which is like a spy story, like we read in the Cold War books. And that triggers Gorbachev, and he decides to write a letter to Reagan asking for a pre-summit. They had agreed to meet in 87, whether in Moscow or Washington, but he wants to see Reagan again, and he wants to talk more.
Because there were these events that you mentioned, Chernobyl and an exchange of an alleged spy, the Danilov incident. These things were heating up the tensions between the countries,
right?
And so Gorbachev is wanting to move up this summit to meet sooner than expected.
Exactly. But also Gorbachev, he's scared of the American Strategic Defense Initiative, which is the Star Wars, as the media called it at the time. So Reagan has been pushing that program publicly since 1983. And after Chernobyl, after realizing the lack of modernity in the nuclear system in the Soviet Union, Gorbachev wants to precipitate, to rush nuclear discussions, wanting to decrease arsenals in both countries. Yes.
Because Star Wars, when Reagan announced it, you know, it was this fantastic idea of satellites that would use lasers to shoot missiles out mm-hmm. of the sky. A lot of people laughed, but the Russian government, the Soviet Union government, was not laughing. I mean, this was something that they were taking seriously as an escalation. If the U.S. had no fear of their weapons anymore, mutually assured destruction was no longer in effect. And so the predictability of this bipolar model of the Cold War was going to go out the window, right?
That's right. And the Americans presented SDI as a defense system. But of course, the Soviets saw it as an offensive, potential offensive weapon system. If you can send a laser from space on a missile in flight, well, obviously, you can also attack, right? So, indeed, I mean, it was taken really, really seriously by the Soviets. Here in the United States, it was pretty controversial. Like the scientific community at the time, if you read the press of the time, or even the memos that President Reagan had inside the White House, the scientific community, the allies of the United States, all Western Europe were against it. Maybe not Maggie Thatcher, but most of the other ones says, you can't arm the space. You're going one step further. So Gorbachev understood that and felt that SDI was a danger for the Soviet Union. That's why he wanted to talk about it.
So he's pushing up this summit. Gorbachev is between the U.S. president and himself. They arrive in October of 86 in Iceland. The two camps are, you know, meeting in a home. It's not really big enough for the two groups, you know. And I just really want to quickly recommend that people read about this scene in your book, "An Impossible Dream: Reagan, Gorbachev, and a World Without the Bomb." I'm speaking with Guillaume Serena, journalist and author of this book about this historic summit between the U.S. president and Mikhail Gorbachev, because, you know, it's kind of unbelievable that, you know, a delegation sent from the U.S. and from the Soviet Union to negotiate the balance of world power and the future of the safety of humanity, they're meeting in sort of this, you know, inappropriately small space where they're sort of having to sit in the hallway to like write memos. And it's a kind of a funny situation. So a great scene in your book. They arrive at the house, you know, very rapidly. I think President Reagan is surprised at how far Mikhail Gorbachev is willing to go in terms of getting rid of the nuclear arsenal of both countries.
Right. So it happens on 2 days. And the first day, indeed, Reagan and his advisors are prepared to talk about a series of issues, such as human rights, such as Afghanistan and other Cold War spots, and of course, nuclear arsenals. But the Soviets come to Reykjavik really with one thing in mind, which is the arms race and dealing with nuclear weapons. So on their first conversation there, and I have to add that the press, the media, there's a blackout. They really don't know in detail what's going to happen. Of course, they know the two leaders will talk, but they don't know really the topics. During that first conversation, they agree that, I quote, a nuclear war cannot be won and shall not be started. So both presidents share that. And, you know, today it sounds normal, but at the time it was pretty bold to say that. So indeed, Gorbachev on that first afternoon, he's pretty aggressive. He's talking extremely directly to Reagan. He knows everything. He knows even some technical issues about nuclear missiles. He has a list of nuclear weapons and missiles category by category. And they seem much more prepared. And from the research I did and seeing the Soviet archives, we now know that Gorbachev had a blank check from the Politburo in Moscow to go as far as he wanted in order to get rid of the maximum nuclear weapons in exchange of getting rid of the SDI. So the Americans are pretty, on that first day, destabilized a little bit. But they do agree on that first day that there should be a huge reduction 50% in intermediate range missiles, which after that led to the INF treaty signed in 87 that we heard about in the news this last few weeks.
And so those are the missiles that are placed in Europe
and
that
Asia.
Can go, yeah. You know, they're not going out of, you know, across
the globe. It's not intercontinental.
Right.
Exactly.
It's just a shorter range missile. We're going to be back with Guillaume Serena, author of the new book, An Impossible Dream, Reagan, Gorbachev, and A World Without the Bomb. He's taking us to this summit in 1986 between Mikhail Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan, when the two leaders came extremely close to eliminating nuclear arsenals. Some of their work developed into treaties that later laid the framework for, you know, really putting the Cold War behind us, or at least, you know, a lot of people maybe assumed that it was. Now there's been a number of developments in recent weeks and the past year or so, you know, nuclear arsenals being built back up again by Russia, the U.S. and China. We're going to talk about it all coming back. I'm Libby Denkman here for Larry Mantle, back after this short break on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KBCC. Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. Larry's feeling just a little under the weather, so he's taking the day off. Happy to be here with you. In studio with me is Guillaume Serena, a journalist and author of the new book, An Impossible Dream, Reagan, Gorbachev, and A World Without the Bomb. And Guillaume, we're in this summit in a house in Reykjavik in Iceland. The first day has gone by, and the Americans, President Reagan, is surprised by how far Mikhail Gorbachev wants to go to eliminate nuclear stockpiles. But they are very focused, the Soviet group, on also eliminating the Star Wars project that was nowhere near actually being functional, but something that was in development that the U.S. had touted and that the Soviets were very afraid of. Ultimately, what happens the next day? What becomes the sticking point that they just cannot overcome?
Right. So during the night, both groups negotiate and get technical and try to put some things on paper about what was discussed on the first day. But indeed, that second day is getting extremely dramatic. You can feel the tension in the room when you read the conversations. You have Reagan with Schultz, the Secretary of State. You have Gorbachev and Shevardnadze. You have note takers and translators, obviously. And here that morning, Gorbachev goes, you know, put all his cards on the table, and he says, "Look, why don't we get rid of all nuclear weapons? Each category, including intercontinental missiles. And why don't we do this in 10 years? And within these 10 years, you guys can research and develop the Strategic Defense Initiative, Star Wars." So indeed, the Americans are pretty surprised of such a bold move from Gorbachev. And you can feel that the American side is pretty divided.
Yeah, how does Reagan respond to that kind of an offer? He in his heart, it wants to reduce nuclear stockpiles. Mm-hmm. That was something he was vocal about.
He was vocal about even from way before being elected president. It's really something that he cares about. He hates nuclear weapons. So on that, they do agree, you know, and these two people actually get along. But during that afternoon, you can feel the tension. You can feel the emotion. You can feel sometimes they get carried away. They yell at each other. Sometimes they have tears in their eyes. So on the American side, Reagan seems exhausted on that last afternoon. Schultz is pushing. You can see it when he intervenes in the conversation. He tells Gorbachev, "Wait a second, are you saying that you want to get rid of all nuclear weapons?" And he's pushing for a deal. He's pushing Reagan for a deal. In the other room, all the people from the defense department are telling Reagan, "Don't strike a deal. We can't trust. This is the Soviet Union." There's a distrust factor from the other side too, as well, to be honest. So the tension will arise about the research and development of the SDI. And Reagan says, I promised it to the American people. You know, 3 weeks from now, there's the midterm elections. So that must have been in his head. He says we need to research and develop it. And 10 years, you know, we want to be able to develop that in space. And what Gorbachev is proposing is actually research and development in the laboratory.
And that's such a sticking point.
And that's the key word.
The laboratory. What does a laboratory mean? There's conversations about, especially later, you know, a laboratory can mean many things. But at the time, in that conversation in Reykjavik, mm-hmm. the idea that, you know, they would only be able to test in a lab and not, you know, elsewhere outside, you know, I guess in the world.
Exactly.
That was the sticking point for Americans.
Well, at the point, and still today, 33 years later, that's a technology that doesn't exist. So 10 years was, you know, to give time for something that's extremely complicated. I mean, imagine putting lasers on satellites, how much it costs, how complicated it is technically, in terms of maintenance as well. Today, we're still not doing it. So that's the dramatic and the irony of that history is that they didn't strike a deal. Maybe today we would live in a nuclear bomb-free world because of a technology that didn't even exist and still doesn't exist.
But as you suggest in your book, Star Wars was, you know, one more chip on this pile of spending and escalation and proof that the United States would financially be able to bury the Soviet Union eventually. I mean, the truth of what was happening mm-hmm. behind or below the surface, below the PR by the Soviets was the economy was not going to be able to sustain the arms race.
Right. But that was only one of the bets, one of the factors. I know today a lot of people and the American literature says, oh, that was a total goal and a will to outspend the Soviet Union. It's more complicated than that. Indeed, that was one of the strategy. And we know that today some people in Washington, in the State Department and Defense Department, was aiming to that. We now have the proof. But it was a very risky poker play, right? And as we know now, the dislocation, the destruction from the inside of the Soviet Union had multiple factors, including a lot of inside factors, whether political, economical, even ethnical. So it's complicated.
It is complicated. Isn't that always the case with history? We're speaking with Guillaume Serena, the author of a new book, An Impossible Dream, Reagan, Gorbachev, and a World Without the Bomb. What comes out of Reykjavik? The talks fall apart. The agreement to actually reduce or remove all nuclear warheads is not reached. But there are some concrete agreements that eventually come from these talks, right?
Sure.
And tell me about those and then we can connect them to today.
Sure. Well, first, it's true. It's a huge missed opportunity. That was probably the only window, and that was Gorbachev was telling Reagan. You know, we were not that close to be able to do that before, and you don't know who's going to succeed me and what's going to happen. So let's do it. We have a narrow window. And indeed, the history tells us that it never happened again. Right. So at least you had a deal that became the INF Treaty, which is the intermediate range missiles that both the United States and Russia withdrawn a couple of months ago today. Then it also led to the first START Treaty in 1988 that was signed between Gorbachev and George H.W. Bush, Reagan's successor. Today, we're under a treaty which would be START number 4. It's called New START that was signed in 2010, which needs to be renewed in February 2021. But we don't know where we stand. We don't know what's going on right now. We don't know if it's going to be sustained.
And just lay the groundwork. START is addressing actual numbers of warheads, whereas the INF treaty was focused on this one type of, ranged, the short-range warheads.
Correct.
Right?
The R in START stands for reduction. So we are reducing the numbers. And obviously it's under that expression, trust and verify, meaning you have American agents on Russian soil making sure they do dismantle all these missiles and weapons. And the same, you have Russian people coming on U.S. soil to do the same.
And as you mentioned earlier, this framework of agreements between the U.S. and what became you know, Russia, formerly the Soviet Union, it did succeed in reducing stockpiles significantly. The numbers are still huge. The numbers are mind-boggling, but it still has reduced them significantly. Why did the INF collapse? Why did these countries pull out earlier this month? And why is START kind of on shaky ground? Are both countries just sort of deciding we want to amp up our warhead game? We want to, you know, invest, and we are interested in an arms race again.
Mm-hmm. Well, both countries accused each other of not respecting the treaty. So that's why the Trump administration decided to do that. And in reaction, the Russians did the same. Yes, these treaties worked. You know, in the 80s, the number of nuclear warheads were three times larger. But why is it important that we have these kind of agreements and that the new START is prolonged? Is that today we have 9 countries with nuclear weapons. Okay, Reykjavik gives us a frame of how this negotiation could happen. You know, still Russia and the United States hold 90% of today's world's arsenal. So first they need to start talking again, right? Then we can imagine a system, an international conference that could be, for example, based on the model of the climate agreement that every country in the world signed in Paris a few years ago. Actually, today, there is a treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons that was signed inside the United Nations in July 2017. You had 70 countries who signed to ban nuclear weapons. 25 of them ratified. So that gives a frame. Of course, all the nuclear countries declined to do so. Of course, being ironic. But saying, you know, let's have a international law treaty that gives us a frame so we can discuss these issues.
I can't help but think about the motivations of a country to decide if they are, you know, capable. They have weapons development systems and scientific communities that are capable of developing nuclear weapons. When they look at the way different countries have been treated on the world stage before and after they develop nuclear weapons. And I'm thinking first and foremost about North Korea and Iran, mm-hmm. the different cases there. You know, Iran has been close to, you know, within striking distance of developing nuclear weapons for some time now. They had agreed to a framework of conditions, you know, under, you know, a recent agreement that the Trump administration decided to pull out of. The rest of the world is still in. But when Iran looks at the way that North Korea, after developing nuclear weapons, is suddenly a country where the U.S. president is visiting and sitting down with its leader, even though this is an isolated country accused of many human rights violations, achieving a nuclear weapon has meant legitimacy for the North Korean, you know, dictator and the North Korean regime. Right. Why does a country who is on unstable footing and maybe isolated from the world decide to not push forward in a framework that we're seeing right now?
It's true. It's a bargaining chip, right? North Korea is using its nuclear program to have sanctions lifted and to enter the world stage. So in that view, it's a success for Chairman Kim of North Korea. To be able to talk with the American president was something unexpected and that he probably dreamed of for a long time. But you have to have a solid agenda. You have to have preparations that last for weeks and months. In my book, I talk about the preparation of Reykjavik. It's incredible how meticulous this is. You know, it's not just for a follow-up.
Diplomacy. It takes a lot of work ahead of time.
That's yeah. correct. Now, Iran, we did have a deal. And if I mind remind our listeners, it wasn't just a deal between the United States and Iran, right? It was a deal with the United Nations, with China, with Russia, and the European Union involved.
So that's the kind of model you're talking about.
Yeah, that took 10 years to accomplish. And, you know, and according to most experts on the planet, it was working. So we do have models, you know, we know how to do it. But it seems like we're in a different era with different objectives and with leaders today that are aiming for other things.
Guillaume Serena joined me here this hour on Air Talk. An impossible dream, Reagan, Gorbachev, and a world without the bomb. I promise the book is more hopeful than the note that we just left the interview on. These issues are just so important, and I thank you so much, Guillaume, for being a part of this conversation today.
Thank you.
Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. Coming up after the news break, we're going to talk about youth sports and participation in youth sports declining over the last decade or so. And what's behind that? If you are somebody who participated in youth sports and faced issues with the cost or stress associated with the sport, various obstacles that might have made you drop out, give us a call, 866-893-5722. Or maybe your coach was overbearing or your parents were pushing too hard. Maybe you yourself are a parent that pushes a little too hard. 866-893-5722. Conversation about youth sports coming up after this news break with Hedy Lynn Hurdies.